Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, filmmaker Tom Sullivan told me about immersing himself in the landscape of the West to tell a story set during the famine in his beautiful new film, Arrit. Author of Big Little Lies and Nine Perfect Strangers, Leanne Moriarty talked to me from Australia about her latest exploration into the dark side of suburbia in her new book, Apples Never Fall. Best-selling author Bob Woodward and acclaimed reporter Robert Costa spoke to me about their new book Peril, which reveals the turmoil underlying the transfer of power between Donald Trump's Republicans and Joe Biden's Democratic Party. Authors of the hugely popular Aisling series, Sarah Breen and Emer McGlycett, told me about the next chapter in Aisling's adventures as she takes on the Big Apple. And legendary Nirvana drummer and Foo Fighters frontman Dave Grohl talked to me about a lifetime of music that left him with many stories to tell. And that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy. All right. I'm 48. I'm nearly 49. May. 48 and a half.
Why would I leave it in?
You don't have to. We're live on air at 9:32. The text number is 51551. And you're thinking, who's he talking to? I'm talking to Tom Sullivan.
Hello.
And Tom, you're very welcome to the program this morning. Because you're responsible for a film called Arrit, which is the Irish form. I'm probably saying it wrong, but let's get down to business.
No, you got it right, Ryan.
Is that all right?
Right, yeah.
It's called, which is translated as Monster. I think before we get into the nuts and bolts, why don't you just give us the pen picture of the film, and then that can put manners on where we go from there.
So it's Arrit is a story about an individual man, a man called Coleman, who is a fisherman who lives in a fishing village in the west coast of Ireland, and it takes place just the summer before the first blight hits. And he tries to rally the village. He can see it coming almost. He predicts that something bad is going to happen where everybody else. Famines have, or shortages have happened before, blights have happened before. But this guy kind of knows that there's something wrong here. So he goes up to the local landlord to plead leniency for rent hikes and stuff. And a terrible incident happens up there, which disables him in a way and means he can't protect his family, and he ends up being, we jump forward 2 years later and he ends up kind of isolated on an island alone. And but the heart of the movie is when he meets a little girl who he has to help, and she kind of brings him
redemption,
kicking and screaming back to life.
Okay, it is. Congratulations. Is it beautiful, thoughtful, reflective, and dare I say it, important film?
Thank you.
No, really. And to you and the crew and the cast, to last man, woman, and literally child, there's something very mournful, melancholic, soulful about the whole experience watching it. And I felt very, very Irish. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I felt very sad for people I hadn't met.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, for me, when I watch it now and I finish making it, it gives me, and during the research period, a great sense of pride about who we are and where we're from.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky enough to have been kind of, thrown into the world of Gaeilge and that world when I was very small. I went to an all-Irish school in Talla, set up by two Connemara people, Páirc MacDonagh, Deirdre and Iolnachán, from down there. But I was lucky enough to be immersed in it.
Yeah.
But what I think the film does is it gives us a sense of pride in the survival and the strength and what we are now and what we have come from and what we've achieved. Mm. And I'm really proud of that. I mean, I think the characters in it are heroic because we are a heroic nation, I feel.
Survival is the word. Yeah. I mean, watching the I don't know where to begin with the film because it's such a big story on such a small island and such a vast scale. And I don't know, I mean, we're pretty much the same age. And I just feel, the reason I thought your film was so important is because I just feel that this story hasn't been, despite everything, despite the amount of books and despite the amount of, paintings, if you want, because I know that was important to you as well.
Yeah.
We still, I don't think we've got a grasp on the enormity of the famine story necessarily.
Yeah, it's funny. And, you know, people ask me why now and why have, you know, we had Black 47 a couple of years ago. Yeah. And why is film starting to have
to
a conversation
yeah,
with it? And I think, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to why, but I know that I know what happened to me. So, I mean, when I, I'll just tell you quickly how it began, the writing process.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm very interested as a storyteller in trauma and characters, trauma, even if I'm writing comedy. I always like to find some kind of itch or something that the character has from early on that they are dealing with, even if it's not, if they're not dealing with it in as part of the narrative, but they're dealing with it. It gives them kind of a three dimension for me.
Okay.
So I always start there. So I started with this character of Coleman Sharkey, who lived off the west coast of Ireland at some time. It could have been post-apocalyptic. It could have been any time.
Oh, so you didn't have a famine story necessarily?
Never, no. Yeah. If I had tried to write a famine film, I wouldn't have written, I wouldn't have got there.
Okay.
Because it's such a big, there's hallowed ground and,
big time.
You know, there would have been a lot of pressure. And I'm not, I didn't jump in there like that. That's not what happened to me. So it began with this person, Coleman Sharkey, and I wrote a scene where he's on a boat, he's fishing, he's scrawny, I was thinking The Road, you know, Cormac McCarthy, it was that kind of world I was in, this kind of post-apocalyptic, these kind of things were occurring to me. What if it's the west of Ireland, it's some time, but this man has been ostracized from his community and he's living this feral existence on an island. That is all I had. And then because I have such a close relationship with Connemara, growing up in Talla, but having that close relationship with there, and my partner 20 years is from Kilsallagh, which is between Rossmuck and Carna, and my two kids have been are going to Irish schools, and so I'm always back there, and the landscape I find conjures up these ghosts, and you can see it in the land. You can see the abandoned ridges and the boniness of the landscape, you know, jutting through the soil, and it's just hugely evocative, and it always has been for me. So, I mean, that's where so the character was based there. He had a trauma that I didn't know what it was, but then I found this famine started to walk into the script. It just started to appear, and it became so that the film became about the famine. Not that it's a film about the famine, but the famine became the backdrop, almost through a kind of a process of osmosis.
Mm.
And that was my way in. So when people ask me, you know, oh, you've made this film about the famine, that was daring. That was never what I intended to do. The famine just kind of happened.
But that's, I think you described it perfectly in the sense that even the road, the Cormac McCarthy reference, and post-apocalyptic. But actually, in some ways, it's apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And that's that landscape in Connemara you describe, I often, I'm sure everyone else does too, describe it as lunar.
Yes.
It's so vast, again, to use that word, and so hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, because it's to hell or to Connacht, but, you know, where do you put a beast of burden on that? I mean, the only beasts of burden were the humans trying to struggle on periwinkles and maybe a lucky
the people that it shaped. I mean, the people that it shaped, which are, you know, our diaspora, they're all over the world. They're the cowboys that wandered the plains of America. They're, I mean, that landscape shapes such hardened, but also lyrical people somehow. And I mean, not to romanticize too much. I mean, obviously it was tough, but I think there's something very dramatic and very evocative about the place.
Well, that's another thing I loved about your movie, Arrigt, was those stone cottages the ruins you see on the bog road between Clifton and Roundstone, wherever you might be in Rossmuck or Lettermore or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I often look at them and it's a bit like if you go to Rome or something, you want to close your eyes and imagine a chariot hurling around the Circus Maximus. But equally, if you're on the bog road, you'd love to close your eyes and see a thatch roof and the walls complete and children playing outside, which you've done in the film, which is... And there was something very beautiful before the storm, as it were.
Yeah.
Where you think, okay, so these were our forebears.
Yes.
Not that long ago.
No.
This isn't like, you know, 500 years ago.
No.
Not that long ago. In fact, they're probably granny, great, great, great. There's only a few.
Yeah.
And you brought them to life. I thought there was a dignity to that.
Yeah, what I wanted to do is dramatically show the world before it happened.
Yeah.
Very quickly, because, you know, you've only got 90 minutes in a movie. So the first 20 minutes set up the place and the village. And I think what a lot of people don't know is, you know, we were quite a strong, we were quite a strong race. And what I try and show is a healthy Ireland before this happened. You have a fishing village, a thriving kind
strapping
of community.
Children and happy.
Yeah, people, not to romanticise. Mm-hmm. I mean, things were tough, but these people were well able. Is what I was trying to show.
And you filmed, I kept thinking it was like a dystopian Paul Henry painting gone mad.
Yeah.
Where did you film?
So Litermullon was where we ended
up.
So I looked, so me and the DOP, the director of photography, Kate McCullough, she's brilliant. We went on a recce together. So we travelled the West Coast. It was set in Connemara but we were thinking logistically wise, where I wanted to shoot was difficult because it's better to be closer to a city or a hub, for all sorts of reasons, insurance reasons as well. So we were looking up in Achill, and then we looked down the south coast a little bit. But when I got out of the car, we were on a recce and out in Litermullon out there. Like, Connemara is one thing, but Litermullon is another thing altogether. Mm-hmm. And there is just, if you kind of multiply it by, if you're in Spittal looking out at the fields in Connemara, multiply that by 10 and you're out in Litermullon. It's where, for the audience, it's where Ireland breaks up into tiny little islands that you can see on the map. And
yes.
Anybody who wants to immerse themselves in where we're really from and our culture, take a trip to Litermullon someday and walk around.
As somebody who spent my childhood summers in that part of the world, there's a sound, and you got it. You got it really well done in the movie. There's a sound, the stone walls they made it. And there's at one stage, you like in your arrogance and ignorance, you think they've always been there, but then somebody had to put them there. And it wouldn't surprise me that it was probably around the time that this film was set in the mid 19th century. But there's a sound if you ever move one of those rocks on
yes.
that wall.
Yes.
Do you know the scrape of the one stone on that? It's very.
Yeah, the sound is a massive part of the film. And
the
guys who did all the sound design, they actually won an IFTA for their work.
Is that right? Fair play.
So the sound is massively important in the film. So that's why the fact that it's going into cinemas is such a thrill for me.
This is a great development, I think, the
incredible.
Cinema thing, because the movies have been ruined. Movies at home have been ruined because there's just too much distraction, whether it's the kettle or the phone.
Yeah.
Cinema. Shut it all off and focus.
Yeah, cinema. I mean, we were supposed to go. We were supposed to go back in April 2019, I think, after the Dublin Film Festival.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And that didn't happen for us. The pandemic just put a stop to everything. So the fact that we're getting a chance, because back then we thought it's not going to happen, but now it's going to be in 50 cinemas nationwide. And for me. The biggest, you mentioned the subtitles, the Irish language.
Yes.
I mean, if I could achieve that people would actually go and not go to this as an Irish language film, but go to it as a film that happens to be in Irish. Because the Irish is the authenticity of it. You couldn't really make it in any other language.
I was worried, and I'll be frank with you, Tom, I was worried before going into it that, and I can say this now because my worries were dealt with pretty swiftly in going into the film, I was worried there mightn't be enough good actors who can speak beautiful Irish.
Yeah.
And that, I presume, if I was worried as a...
No, it's a
as
small...
As a consumer, you must have been worried.
No, it's so true because, casting is so difficult and To suddenly go, okay, not only did they have to speak Irish, but for me, it was important that the main characters not only spoke Irish, but that it was a what they call Cainteoir Óbaile or Cainteoir Ó-Ruachais, which is they learned Irish at home. There's a different sound to it to somebody who speaks Irish at home than the Irish we learned in school. It's they form muscles, I think, that you just can't, you can't get your mouth around that way of speaking Gaelic. So the authenticity of the way these guys speak. But luckily, we have the Robert De Niro and Harvey Keitel of the acting world. We just happen, timing-wise, I don't think if we tried to make this film 20 years ago or 20 years into the future that we would just looked out with these guys. We happen to have these incredible actors.
You better name check that, particularly the two or three
Don
leads.
So Donal O'Haley plays
really
the lead. We have, there's Donal O'Haley. There's Sasha Quinn plays the little girl.
Brilliant.
And then obviously we have Dara Devaney who plays Patsy, the bad guy.
It's great. So, and then you have the likes of Peter Coonan
in. And Michael McElhattan play the...
Give us a bit of posh and a bit of the British and so on. Who did the score for the film? Somebody wants to know.
Keela.
Keela, of course. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah, that's a good fit.
And that was an incredible experience because Keela just brought me into there. I was in the middle of the edit. It was a really tough edit because low-budget films are tough because you have to almost rewrite it in the edit. And Keela just put their arms around me and brought me into this lovely creative space.
Good on them.
Yeah.
Text says, consider all the films about the Holocaust, Vietnam, even 9/11. It makes sense that films are now being made about the famine as our filmmakers develop and can take their place on the world stage. I'm looking forward to seeing this film. That is a very good point. It's so heartening for the country to know that this film is coming about. And as I say, Oscar Ilge, and as somebody who doesn't have Irish to speak of, I was really enjoying picking up bits of it, like getting an answer right in University Challenge. So it wasn't a lot, but I was happy enough with the album. The famine was yesterday to many of us, says a text here from Fintan. He says, I'm only 68, but as a child, I heard stories of the famine from my grandmother, who heard them from her grandmother as a child, who was a child during the famine. So I'm just one person removed from the story of the famine. That is possibly the essence of why we've been so reluctant to, because it was the great shame. Ultimately, maybe a more modern word might be the great embarrassment.
Actually, I was going to say that, weirdly, the connection with Coleman and his trauma, his childhood trauma, was that Ireland as a person, I think our childhood trauma is the famine. And I think in a weird way, we're starting to engage with it now. And hopefully it'll bring something that, you know, I think in engaging with those hard times in our history, it will serve us as a nation as well, you know.
Couldn't agree with you more. Tom, it's great to see you. Congratulations. Tom Sullivan is the man behind Arik, and that is going to be in cinemas from October the 15th, which is pretty much Friday week, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
Good luck with it. We'll keep the flag flying for it because I think, as I say, it's not only important, but it's also a beautiful and extraordinary film. So well done to you and the gang.
Thank you, Ryan.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in to see us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it very much. It's 12 minutes to 10. It's a little after 9:30 this Tuesday morning. Great to have you with us, as always. Let's go straight and live to Sydney, Australia, and say good morning to Leanne Moriarty. Good morning, Leanne. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Ireland.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you so very much.
Well, you are the author of Big Little Lies, Nine Perfect Strangers, and congratulations on the release of your latest book, which we're going to talk about in just a second, called Apples Never Fall. But do you know what I'd love to talk to you about is, because we were talking a little bit about this domestic violence this morning, and you approach it in very full on in Big Little Lies, at least. One thing that you do in your books a lot is you see what looks on the face of things normal, functional, beautiful, the cause of some envy. And then when you look a little closer, there's an ugly truth.
Mm.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yes, that's just something I'm interested in exploring, not just in terms of horrible truths, but even, the tiny differences between what we present to the world and what we're really thinking. And in Big Little Lies, I think it was an article I read, and then I really looked into it. I remember reading a book called Not to People Like Us, which was, about the wives of wealthy, successful men who had this terrible secret and who looked from the outside, exactly as you said, that had it all, but, we had terrible things going on behind closed doors.
And you see that, don't you? I mean, you've talked about this before, where you go into a housing estate and you see manicured gardens and well-painted doors and so on. But really what lies beyond those doors, they're all mini novels in themselves.
Yes, exactly. Behind every door is a mini novel, and there are tragedies, but of course there are also beautiful moments going on behind those doors.
I'm going to mention the domestic violence one more time, just on the basis that when you, as you've written about it, as it was portrayed in Big Little Lies, very violent. I thought it was very important to confront that violence in a visceral way, the way you did it, rather than kind of hide behind the niceties of maybe a montage or a story being told by somebody else in a coffee shop. Do you think that's important now more than ever, Leanne, in terms of 2021 and confronting the ugliness of it all, rather than, as we've done, I know, in this country for too long in the past, just sweep it under the carpet and really just not let it out?
Absolutely. We need to show the ugliness, although I guess we need to show it in a way so that people don't entirely turn away, so they don't close the book or switch off the television. So, you know, that is the point of art, so it still tells a story. And, you know, when I wrote Big Little Lies, I still wanted to entertain, but I know that part of what that book did, I had people coming up to me at events and saying, I left a relationship because of this book. And I always remember one woman in particular who said, I gave this book to all my friends and said, read this book because this is me. So that was her way of telling people, you know, what she'd never revealed before. So, but yes, in the same way though, I had to make, I had humour, and I guess what I did have in Big Little Lies, you know, what really would have happened to Celeste is that he would have killed her in the end. But because this was fiction, she got her happy ending. And so what I guess then my hope would be that people reading that book would get out sooner, so they get their happy ending before it's too late, right at the very beginning. Because often women say they can look back to that very first time and they know that's when I should have left.
Yes, I appreciate that. And it just the story rings true in this country this morning, as there was a case that was a very heavily reported. It's in all our newspapers this morning about a beautiful young woman who was really just snatched from her family after a violent assault by a former partner. And we're all kind of reeling. We're a small island. Yeah. And we're all kind of reeling from it because she's everyone's sister, daughter, you know.
Yes. Yeah. That's so distressing. And I'm so sorry that it happens. You know, that why do we keep hearing these stories over and over again?
It comes down to, in some ways, education, and I say that as a segue to your own story in primary school and your father. Actually, I love this idea that he kind of commissioned you to write a story. But what I love is the paternal encouragement in that story. Maybe you'd share it with us.
Yes, when he discovered that my sister and I liked to write stories, so I'm the eldest of six children, and when he discovered that, then he said, well, I will commission your first publishing deals. So he would pay us to fill an exercise book filled with words. But he did then have a plastic roulette wheel and he'd play roulette against us and win back all the money that that he'd paid us for for our writing.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's clever or mean. I'm not quite...
It was nice. The good thing about it was that it made us take our writing seriously, and it sort of validated our. And because Dad's thing was always, you know, if you can do whatever it is, if you can do something that you love, he'd say, if you can do something that you love and some bastard will pay you to do it, then there's nothing better than that.
Well, I know what they're saying there. What about this idea? As a father of daughters myself, a beautiful young women now, I was intrigued to hear you talk about something called the confidence gap. I wasn't aware of it. I find myself in a perpetual state of learning about the world. But this idea of, you know, young girls between the ages of 8 and 14, very specific. Have been found to have self-confidence that it plummets significantly.
Yes, I've read about it. I'm not sure. I can't tell you what causes it, but I remember, and when I read about it, it just really resonated with me, because that's exactly what happened to me, that I was a sort of little girl who wrote school plays, and I invited the whole school class to come and rehearse at my place, and then performed the play. And then as I became a teenager, that all fell away. And sometimes when I look back, I think, did I start to become, even though it's in, you know, this was back in the 70s, it's nothing like it is now, the obsession with your appearance, but did I start to think that all that mattered was, do boys like me? Was that what it was about? I honestly don't know.
But it's called the confidence gap, I suppose. But then I wonder, was it ever thus? You know, teenagers and those years, they tend to be times of, you know, considerable vulnerability. In any event, for boys and girls.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, I'm sure the same applies to boys. Maybe it happens at a different time, or maybe they're better at hiding it and pushing themselves through it.
Well, that's a very good observation, because fellas tend to be better at hiding things, B, not talking about things, and definitely C, being the loudest voice in the room.
Yes, exactly. So maybe that's the answer.
congratulations on your new book, obviously, Apples Never Fall. And we're back to, I think it's terra firma for you, isn't it? Dark, twisty, family saga, sordid suburbia. Yeah, this is your home. this is your home turf. Can you give us the nutshell version of the book just for our listeners who haven't read it?
Sure. So it's about Joy and Stan Delaney, who are retired tennis coaches, and they've just sold their very successful tennis school. And they have four adult children and sadly no grandchildren. So they're a little bit lost. They're empty nesters and they're not the sort of people who are very good at retirement. And then it's what happens when Joy goes missing and Stan becomes the main person of interest in her disappearance. And so the four adult children have to deal with the possibility that perhaps their father was responsible. So they're, you know, how it's hard enough to look at your parents as just flawed human beings, let alone to consider the terrible possibility that your father may have murdered your mother. So that's the premise.
Well, and so begin. There's not much more we can say on that, because we just give it away, because it's just such a rollicking sort of thriller. But you do throw up the questions there anyway. How would you feel if your father was accused of killing your mother, and the siblings gathering around saying, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, and now you're into, even within families, that whole notion of factions and taking sides and so on. I mean, it's all there.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to explore. And the different ways that siblings all look back on the same childhood, and the different ways they would view their parents' marriage. So that's what really interested me.
You've made a habit of writing books that are absolutely tailor-made for massively successful television productions. I mean, Big Little Lies, I think it was 8 Emmys and 4 Golden Globes and 9 Perfect Strangers, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I have to say, I actually thought Melissa McCarthy was a real standout in that, because I was so used to one side of her. I thought she was very moving in that.
Yeah, she's absolutely, absolutely wonderful as Frances. Well, I thought actually the whole cast was incredible.
I agree with you. And you know, you find yourself, Leanne, moving in kind of different circles to the circles most authors would do. Although we did have our own one of our own great writers, Cecilia Hearn, here recently talking about having, you know, dealings with Nicole Kidman for her book. So Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, both of whom you've dealt with, they're doing great things for books, aren't they? I mean, it's that lovely conflation of the great medium of television, but also of literature.
Yes, exactly. And it means that there are wonderful television being made, but of course, as authors, it's bringing, you know, so many more readers to our books. So that's why, as authors, we're so grateful. I'm so grateful for that. Apart from the fun of getting to see my characters come to life.
Do you enjoy that aspect of it? I mean, you are writing these vastly successful books, as I say, over 20 million books sold, and then you find yourself on the phone saying,
I want Meryl Streep or I'm not going to be happy, and throwing your pen down. I mean, is it that much fun? I think we've lost. No, you're still there. Good, go on.
I'll keep having fun. Oh, sorry, yes. No, I'm still here. Good. I want to still be there. I had a lot of fun. That was for season two of Big Little Lies, coming up with a character, particularly for the role of Meryl Streep. That was a career highlight.
Yes.
And it's incredibly fun just to visit the sets and see how it all comes together. But I have to say, for me, the main goal is still definitely the book, because that's between me and the reader. So every single reader that, they use their imagination and it's my imagination. So that feels very personal. And also I'm in charge of that world. So when I've handed it over each time, I've been very happy to let it go. But I do love, once I'm back to my book, I love being in charge of my characters.
Kate in Sligo here in Ireland says, Leanne Moriarty is my absolute hero. Her writing is so impactful and yet light, effortless, hilarious. Her characters are full and empathetically rendered, flaws and all. She's an incredible author. It's so wonderful to hear her speaking on the show this morning. Do you feel, I know you've spoken on this before, I won't dwell on it for too long, but as a writer in 2021 versus a writer in 2011, do you feel an extra pressure to make your books more diverse, make your books more culturally appropriate, et cetera, et cetera? Or do you just plow on, carry on regardless?
Well, thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you so much to that lovely person for their text.
Sure.
And yes, definitely the world has changed. And so anybody who's making any kind of art has to be aware of that. I guess as I'm writing, I think I could become paralyzed if I started to think too much about that. The important thing is, once I've finished writing, to look back and see, you know, have I got enough diversity? I do think my earlier books, I think most of us as authors probably automatically write from, you know, from your own point of view. Mm. So all my characters, they probably all sounded quite Irish Catholic background. Mm. And so I think in this book, for example, you can see a marked difference and that the characters would more reflect exactly the sort of characters that I see in my own neighbourhood. But then my main characters will probably always be like me, because I don't think it's my place to write from another cultural background, because then I could rightfully be accused of cultural appropriation. So it's a tricky balance, and it should be tricky. Hopefully I'm getting it right. And I think once we have diversity in the authors, so in the books that are being written, then it will no longer be such an issue. Because I always think if it was only men that were writing books, then I, as a woman, would think. And, you know, if they then sometimes tried to write from a female point of view, I'd say you're not getting it right. Mm. If they then tried to put a few female characters in their books, I'd say you're not getting it right. It wouldn't matter what they did until I had a chance to write my own books. So that's what we need to get that balance right. And we're obviously getting there.
Slowly but surely, no doubt about
it. Yes.
Leanne, I'm sorry we have to go at this point, but I wanted to say thank you for your time this morning. I hope life is good in Australia and that you're all surviving the other thing we don't need to mention. But
we're all good. It was lovely talking to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Leanne. To you and your family, and I wish you every happiness and good luck, and hopefully meet you in Ireland the next time you're in town. Best of luck. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you. Leanne Moriarty joining us from Sydney, Australia. Beautiful. I mean, technology worked quite well there, actually, in fairness. I thought we lost it for a second, but we didn't. And a lovely person. And her books, Big Little Lies, Nine Perfect Strangers, you may have watched them, you may have read them, but certainly her new one is called Apples Never Fall. And that is all in all good bookshops now. I'm so delighted, says the text, to hear my absolutely favourite author
Leanne Moriarty being interviewed. Her books are so gripping and engaging. I'm currently listening to Apples Never Fall. And of course, that's one way I think a lot of people I know now are listening to books as much as, if not more than, reading the hard copy itself. But nothing wrong with that. Any which way, let's take a break. The legendary American journalist Bob Woodward, joined this time by Robert Costa, another fine journalist, has completed the third of his trilogy of books reporting on the Trump presidency. We've had rage, we've had fear, and now we're looking at peril. Bob Woodward, good morning. And let me begin by asking about the peril that you talk about. Is it the danger of the re-election of Donald Trump? Is it the threat to the US democratic system? Or even what the book opens with, the threat of a possible coup d'etat in the United States?
Well, it's many dangers. The first, there's the element of surprise. When Robert Costa and I worked on this, we discovered that there was a national security crisis which was concealed and not known, that there was profound worry that China thought the United States was going to attack them. And, of course, that's the worst kind of hair trigger environment where tensions with China are so great already. And so before the election, General Milley, who is chairman of the Joint Chiefs, number one military man in the United States, called his equivalent in China, General Li, and said, "No, we're not going to attack you. Calm down. They have a 5-year relationship," and he played on that, and he was couldn't have been more worried. And as we know in the history of war, miscommunication is the seed of conflict. And then 2 days after the insurrection in the United States at the Capitol, a monumental event, an attack on the seat of government, trying to keep Biden from being pronounced president. 2 days after that, the Chinese thought the United States might collapse, and they went on military alert. The Iranians did the same, the Russians. So that's historic peril, and then the peril continues that Trump, who really tried to overturn the election and continues with that theme of the stolen election, he's so popular among Republicans that he may get the nomination for 2024, and some polling shows that he could win.
The episodes, as outlined by you there, Bob, and indeed in your book, really serve to illustrate the fragility of democracy in America, I suppose, in some ways. And I think that when you read your book, you really get a sense that what reading the newspapers or online really wasn't enough, because we didn't get, in some ways, half the story. The threat to democracy, the state of the union, and the state of diplomatic affairs and relations was on a razor edge.
Yes, exactly, on a razor edge. And democracy works, as you know, but it is fragile. And particularly when you have a sitting president like Trump, who was just raging against China, where he was before the election last year that he lost, he said if he lost, it would be stolen. And now he's playing that theme very, very hard. Mm. And if you have a sitting president who cannot accept what happened at the ballot box, and we were able to dig into that and discover documents that Trump, some of his really big supporters, investigated his claim that this was a stolen election and found zero to support it. But he continues with that, and there, according to polling, tens of millions of people in this country who believe him and accept that.
There are nerving exchanges throughout the book of President Trump, then President Trump, and his close aides. And, you know, close to the beginning, you talk about the Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking to General Milley. And really, the topic of conversation that keeps coming up is the mental stability of the president. And that's where it gets into the realms of almost science fiction. It seems so surreal. You looked at the man in the eye. You spoke to him for all these books in the last 4 years. And, you know, is it overstating the case to suggest that Donald Trump has mental stability issues? Or is that just a neat line for Democratic voters?
Well, General Milley and Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, second in line for the presidency, somebody who knows the whole procedures for using nuclear weapons and launching some sort of military action. She, in this call, we have a transcript with Milley. She calls him and says, what guarantees are there that President Trump will not use nuclear weapons? I need guarantees. And Milley says, oh, no, our procedures are sound. And then he realizes very, very clearly that the procedures could be circumvented by a president who's in mental decline, which Milley concluded was the case. And all of those scenes that we have in the book of Trump just raging in the Oval Office, screaming at people, irrational, not stable. And so Milley invokes the procedures with the war room officers in the Pentagon and says, we've got to make sure that I, General Milley, number one military man, that I'm at the table, I'm on the network if there's any call from Trump or anyone to use nuclear weapons or launch some sort of military action. An extraordinary moment, only happened once before in 1974 with Nixon, when Nixon's instability caused the Secretary of Defense at the time to put the same sort of restrictions and make sure that nothing would happen that would take the United States into a war or the brink of war. And of course, under the U.S. Constitution, the president is the commander-in-chief and can do what he wants with the military. There's no vote. No one else has a say.
The terrifying thought, but nevertheless, it's worked so far in the American experiment, if you like. But one of the things about your book is that you and Robert Costa have put together a book that dwells a lot on the pre-election and ultimate election of Joe Biden. And the word soul keeps coming up page after page, conversation after conversation, and it kind of stems from what happened in Charlottesville and the Trump reaction to that. How critical is that word to Biden's campaign victory and ultimately presidency?
Well, it was the stimulating thought that Trump doesn't represent soul, and that you really need an American president who will adhere to the procedures and respect the process. And of course, Trump only respects himself. Is Robert Costa?
I'm glad to say Robert has just joined us. Robert Costa, welcome to the program. Nice to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
Well, Robert, maybe I could ask you, Robert Costa, about that expression. Donald Trump was not an American president. What does that mean?
What you see in Biden's winding path to the presidency in 2020 is a different Joe Biden. You brought up the question of soul. And in 1988 and 2008, Joe Biden has failed bids for the presidency. And both of those bids, based on our reporting, were very much driven, sure, by policy issues and an agenda, but also driven by ambition. But by 2018, after watching what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, a year prior, Biden's back on the campaign trail, and instead of going into political winter, he really, to Bob Woodward's point, sees Trump as an existential threat to American democracy, an un-American figure. And so instead of being driven by ambition for the third time around, our reporting shows he is actually driven more by a mission that Trump has to be stopped. And that really is where the soul theme also intertwines. You see Biden seeing the soul of America, democracy, under threat.
Yeah, I got the sense from your book, and not to be glib about it, but there was a moment over and over again with his advisors that there was a sense of let Bartlett be Bartlett. You know what I mean by that West Wing reference to Joe Biden going, maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. They said, no, just be yourself.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was sort of a West Wing moment, and if you remember President Bartlett, to just veer there for a split second, Bartlett was also a Catholic like Biden, couched his politics and Democratic politics in kind of a Catholic spirituality. And you see that with Biden, too. John Meacham, the American historian, has written a book about the soul of America that uses a lot of Biden's same themes about the better angels in American history and American values. And all of that experience from Biden's Senate days, his faith, his upbringing in Scranton, Pennsylvania, that all infused the soul campaign theme that ultimately was successful in beating Donald Trump.
I remember when John Kerry was running for office, and I think it was Karl Rove said that by the time we've finished with John Kerry, the American people won't know on which side of the American war he fought. And that came to mind when I was reading your book and the comments Donald Trump made about what they would do to Joe Biden and his name and his family's name when they got their hands on him. It was very menacing.
Very menacing is exactly right. But Biden beat him last year. And if you look at it, it was by 7 million votes, which is substantial. But if you look at the individual states, which is the way they count who's going to win, if 45,000 votes in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia had shifted, Donald Trump would have been reelected president last year. So it was very, very close. What, of course, in the news to these days is Biden is president, he's having a real hard time. Soul goes only so far, and the mechanics of running, actually trying to manage the government, even though the Democrats control Congress and control the White House, there are lots and lots of troubles.
Well, there are. I mean, when President Biden got elected, there was a sense globally among so many people was that he was a balm, he was a salve, he was going to put manners on an office that had lost control and so on. And yet, like you say, you can't run a campaign on balming and salving and and soul. The realpolitik gets in the way of those things. So how do you assess his performance to date? Maybe I'll put that to you, Robert Costa, in the sense that we all watched the American withdrawal from Afghanistan and wondered, was that a great success for him domestically and maybe not so much internationally? Or was it a boon to Donald Trump's nascent re-election campaign?
Our book shows that in November of 2020, Donald Trump actually signed a rogue memo that went outside of the usual channels on Afghanistan to have a rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops. And so you see a complicated story on Afghanistan. Our book shows President Trump almost rushing, pushing to get out, not consulting with generals such as Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or even his Secretary of Defense. So there's a Trump component in the book that adds context to the bigger Afghanistan narrative. And then the Biden story is so much driven by his own experiences in the Senate and in the White House under President Obama as his vice president. And now you have all this barreling toward 2022. Afghanistan is certainly going to be part of the campaign discussion next year. But it's hard to predict too much about how a foreign policy issue really lingers politically long term.
Bob Woodward, you described President Trump at the beginning of our interview as you used different words. I don't know if you were attributing them or you were actually reflecting your own thoughts, but you were suggesting he was a man of mental decline. Yeah, throughout the book you talk about him raging. You said he was not stable. And yet, pretty much half the American people think he's their man for the job. And yet, heading into the next election cycle, he looks like the only show in town for the Republicans. Do you tear your hair out wondering how did this happen, or are you simply unsurprised by the path in history?
As Robert Costa has told me, and this is true, he has a sign over his computer: "Assume nothing,"
yeah.
it doesn't work very well for reporters to pull at their hair.
Mm.
The only solution is more reporting. We were able to find these memos, which are not partisan documents. These are two of the senators, Mike Lee of Utah, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, bedrock Trump supporters, investigate this claim of some sort of stolen election, and they find zero evidence, zero. This is not the Democratic opposition to Trump. These are his supporters. Now, we're going to see what happens, and I've always liked Robert Costa's theme of assume nothing. We don't know where this is going to go. But only remedy for people in our business is to report, talk to people, get notes of meetings, get transcripts like we did of the Pelosi-General Milley call, and look for the documentation. And, you know, we will see. There's assume nothing about the future in American politics, as you know.
And Robert Costa, if I may put a final question to you about that, the future. I appreciate the assume nothing mantra. In fact, I love it and may well adopt it in my own field. But let me ask you about that second Trump term. People are fascinated by the thought of it, and I believe only this week he's planning further rallies, etc. Do you think we'll be back again with the follow-up book?
I know reading Peril can be quite an experience for some people. They've sent me notes. Just reading the January 6th chapters gives them a shiver down their spine. But I would urge people to read the whole book, because when you see at the end is the whole Republican Party, from Senator Lindsey Graham to former aides like Brad Parscale and pollster John McLaughlin, urging Trump to get back in the arena. They want to rehabilitate them. In fact, Brad Parscale, his former campaign manager, says if Trump runs again, he wants an army back, an army for Trump. He had it once. He wants it back. And if he runs again, it will be for vengeance. And this is someone who's now comfortable with power. When Bob Woodward and I first interviewed Trump in March of 2016, he was an outsider. He had never been in elected office. If he comes back, our book shows, and really read it to the end, that this is someone who's now comfortable with the levers of power and how to use it to sustain his own political standing and his presidency, should he get again.
Peril, indeed. Appropriate title for a wonderful book. And for those of you who are as interested in American politics as I am, and that's by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. Bob, Robert, thank you for your time. Congratulations on a marvellous piece of history on the hoof. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Okay, and that book, like I say, Peril, by our guests this morning, Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, is a joy, to be honest with you. I think you'll get great enjoyment out of that, and lessons from history and words of warning. Absolutely terrific. The text number is always 51551. All righty, at 9:20, lovely. It's great to welcome back to the programme Emer McGlyson and Sarah Breen, the brain trust behind the Aisling series, their fourth Aisling book. Aisling in the City is out now. If she can make it there, she'll make it anywhere. She's off to New York. Emer, Sarah, welcome live and in real life to the studio.
Thank you.
Emer, it's not been so long since we last spoke.
No.
So I'll address that by saying thank you so much for being here that morning.
Thank you.
I thought you gave a very visceral, very honest, very searing, truthful account of your life up to that point. And I hope you were okay after it, because that took a lot to do that.
Thanks. It was great to be able to share. I got a great response afterwards, and a lot of people said they found it helpful, which made it worthwhile.
That's all the point. Yeah. We don't need to go back over it other than to say great to see you. Thanks for being here. And your mate.
Who the emotional support dog.
The emotional support dog. Which, and you're actually wearing a high-vis jacket for that very reason today. Good on you, sir. You were sitting upstairs for all of that. How was it for you?
I was sobbing away. I was a very proud friend, and Emer was saying such nice things about me as well, yeah, and being her friend. So that was nice to hear. And, you know, I didn't have an opportunity to talk about what a great friend she is to me. So while I'm here, I just like to say thanks for being a great friend.
Oh my God,
Emer.
Sarah.
It feels like this is your life. You thought you were here for a book conversation, but in fact, today, Emer McGlass said, this is your life.
It's your third class teacher.
Who has strong words with you about that essay you wrote. You spent a lot of time together in the States, didn't you? I mean, it was a lot of time. You visited each other because you were posted there with your husband's job.
Yes, exactly.
What part of the States were you in?
I was there for 3.5 years. We were in Portland and Phoenix, so we're kind of between the two places.
I know nothing about those places. What were they like?
Well, Phoenix is in the desert. It's in the west, near Arizona. California. A very dry heat in Arizona. And it was lovely. Like, I loved the lifestyle out there. Blue skies and palm trees. And I'd moved from an apartment building in Stony Batter with, like, just bins downstairs to, like, an apartment in Phoenix with a swimming pool outside my door. Yeah. So Emer was one of the first people to come and visit me because, I mean, who could say no to a swimming pool?
Not me, anyway.
And how is, I'm getting to America because obviously Aisling is going to New York, so we'll get there in a second. But how did you enjoy the American experience? Because you did a J1 as well, didn't you?
I did a J1 actually in New York.
York. Okay, well, let's go to New York. It sounds a little more exciting than Phoenix.
No offense taken.
When I did visit Sarah in Phoenix, I think both times I visited were off season in that it wasn't 45 degrees because, like a lot of other Irish people, I cannot handle the
heat.
I tweeted this morning going, it's very warm out.
Very warm out.
Just be warned. Don't wear a coat.
It is hot.
Sorry, let's do the Irish thing. Opening the door to go outside to this. Like the,
17 degrees, you
what?
Know.
Yeah. 17 degrees. Yeah. Who knew?
Anyway.
It's beautiful, though.
So, yeah, I was glad.
Back to America.
It was lovely in Phoenix. But, yeah, I did my J1 in 2001, which seems crazy, in New York. But it was just outside New York. It wasn't New York proper. It was I like to call it the bad end of Long Island. So it wasn't the posh end the Hamptons. It was the Queens end.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you kind of got to
But I was working kind of a semi-posh country club. I would say there was a lot of mobsters who remembers.
Because from the movies, I always think the films that country clubs are all posh.
I mean, it was posh, but
I think there's a spectrum of
in the country club
there was an edge to it,
as you say, a bit of a Tony Soprano vibe.
I remember one time serving this there was a lot of very older men and serving him something, and there was something on the side of his plate, and he was like, miss, get this S-H-I-T off my plate.
Okay, that gives us a sense.
I mean, you don't speak to a waitress like that, do you?
Not really.
No.
Sounds like it's not quite Mar-a-Lago.
No,
I think we're... So tell us about Aisling and how she is. I mean, we always talk... She's always the fourth person in the studio here today. So without being disrespectful, how is she and what's happening in her life?
Aisling is great. So at the end of the third book, you might remember...
Yes, of course.
She had just pulled off kind of like the wedding of the century with the help of an American wedding planner or an event architect, is how she would describe herself.
Yes.
And then romantically, things weren't going great at the end of the last book. So fast forward to this book, which happens a couple of months later, and she gets a phone call from said event architect in New York City offering her a job. And of course, I mean, it's the dream, isn't it?
I mean, she does a bit of dithering, but not that much, because what has she got holding her back? So she decides, I'm going to do it.
It's her
time.
I'm
going to New York.
It's her time.
Making it in America is kind of the benchmark of success for Irish people, really. You know, it's like once you've made it over there, it's like you've done it. You know, we get so proud when we see Niall Horan on telly, or like one of, you know, an Irish band is on one of those late night talk shows, you know, or somebody Irish gets like an Oscar nomination.
Oh my goodness.
Bursting with pride. So we're like, okay, let's see if Aisling can make
it
in America.
It's her turn, really, isn't it? And how does she figure in the States? Because in New York is pretty daunting. It's beautiful and fun, but it's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, so Aisling's only experience with New York previously has kind of been 2 or 3 visits, maybe before the Christmas, to buy some presents, to visit the M&M shop in Times Square,
the outlet malls,
to look at the Empire State Building, but you couldn't be queuing, so you just look at it. Get the Staten Island Ferry, it's free, instead of doing the actual tour to the Statue of Liberty. Oh, she's done it all. She knows the place inside out. So she goes over and actually has to live for a little while with not an elderly but an older relative who lives in Queens.
But crucially, as part of the job offer, she goes over on a business class flight.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about that because the business class flight experience, you've been
I've been on the end of some photographs from Emer, who was on a business class.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Emer, you're on the business class.
I was once on a business class flight my life.
This is the most Irish admission. You know, kind of going, I am so embarrassed to admit that I travelled in style because people will judge me. And like, you're actually almost mortified telling me that you travelled in style.
But I'm like, gather around, children, and I'll tell you the
It's
tale.
One of the most exciting things. Like, it's just my dream.
Tell us all about it.
The things are so tiny. The tiny salt and pepper. Like, you wouldn't, but it's like a doll's house. There was people asleep. Like, the business class cabin that I was in, there was maybe 8 seats, and you get your very own seat. There's no elbows, there's nobody touching you. You're in your own little pod almost. And there's people sleeping through the tiny salts and peppers and free drinks.
This is barbaric to me. Like, I would have my eyes on matchsticks. Like, I couldn't miss a single thing
because there's
so much free stuff happening.
There was a remote control for the telly.
And can I ask you, was it Aer Lingus? Or,
it was Aer Lingus,
so
yeah.
You had this Irish vibe to
it
as well.
Yeah, and I got on and she was like, may I hang up your coat? Emer. And I was like, oh my God, who is this angel who knows my name?
Tell me about the free stuff.
The free stuff. So I didn't even see the free stuff, first of all, because it was in like a little locker down by your foot.
A locker. It's far from lockers. You were weird.
And then there was the little bag, and in it was like lip balm and hand lotion, a pair of socks, I think.
Free socks.
Like,
where is this place you speak of?
Eye mask. And then you got a menu for what was coming. She asked, do you want the cocktail of the day or do you want this? And I was like, oh, but give me it all, Siobhan.
I just wish we had a camera on this, because Sarah's looking at you like she's gone to see Santa in Switzerland.
I was sending Sarah pictures the whole time. I mean, I was like,
what's on the menu?
I must have had Wi-Fi because it was business class.
Yes, of course.
I'm surprised they didn't just give me a phone. Oh, welcome, here's a phone.
It's one of my favourite things to ask people about, like getting free upgrades on airlines as well. And everyone has a story, like loads of people get them. A friend of mine is a doctor and she was saying she was on a flight once and they were like, you know, is there a doctor on the plane? And she was like, oh, I want to just enjoy my flight. And then she waited a few minutes and then they were like, is there a nurse on the plane? So then she was like, okay, well, I have to put my hand up here. And there was somebody having trouble, I think a man having trouble breathing or something. Yeah. And they were both moved up to first class. But she said she couldn't even really enjoy
that's
it.
That's a good tip now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you have to be a doctor.
But if you're having trouble breathing.
Yeah, actually,
I think he had to put on quite the performance.
Yeah. I mean,
but she couldn't even enjoy the amenities because she was like keeping an eye on your man. She couldn't have the champagne. So be careful if you're going to do that.
Yeah, you
Here's my
raging.
Next question then. After you've described what sounds like Aladdin's cave of joy and
it
delight.
Joyful.
You know, your personal Narnia with wings.
Yeah.
But my question is this. How do you fly after that?
Well, the saddest tale is directly after that, I landed in New York, had to get a connecting flight.
Oh, back to reality. Oh, gosh.
I was in the centre seat.
Yes.
There was only economy on this tin can that was flying through the air.
Now you're a snob. It's brilliant.
I went up to the desk. Or I think I can't remember. It was one of the American internal airlines.
You weren't going to complain, were you?
Well, I was just like, oh, sorry, I have a business class
ticket. We should, Karen, I'm assuming. New title.
I was very nice. I was like, I have a business class ticket. I'm just wondering where... You know, I don't seem to have a business class seat. And the lady was just like openly laughing, going, "There, what are you talking about? There's no business class seats on this plane."
What a con.
So I had to go and sit with the... Go down amongst the people.
You turned right. You had to turn right.
I had to turn right.
The shame of it.
Anyway, look, I had my business class experience. I will dine out on it until the day
magical.
I die.
It's all detailed in Ashling in the City, which is out today.
That's the whole thing. Yeah. I feel like we were on the flight with you.
Yeah.
Or we were listening to a fireside... story of old. It was a beautiful experience.
It was just wonderful.
I want to fly again now.
Oh yeah, I only want to fly first class now.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about how you feel about the term Karen, when someone's a Karen? Because I feel there's a bit of pushback on it from people saying, you know, it's getting a bit annoying. Or do you think it's gas?
No, being called a Karen is not something that's complimentary at all.
But do you see the humour in it, or do you feel you're both kind of, oh, look at the furrow.
Yeah,
there's a lot of brow furrowing here.
I wouldn't be calling anyone a Karen.
Would
anyway,
you not? Do you think it's
sure.
too pejorative and
yeah,
kind of mean?
Yeah,
it manifested in America a few years ago, and it was kind of, you know, the, well, let me speak to the manager haircut, and it was kind of a middle-aged woman who was always complaining about things. And it has really, I think, like, I hear children now calling people Karens. Like, my friend's son, I remember he was like, oh, so-and-so's such a Karen. And I was like, well, that's not a very nice thing to say about
someone. Yeah, it's filtered down to kids' YouTube now.
It's just become too ubiquitous. And it is quite...
Interesting to get your take on that. Okay. So it's not for everyone. Tell the girls not to give away too much. I can't wait to get the book. So they're just saying, so steady as we go on the
info.
No
more spoilers. Yeah,
we haven't given away too much at all. All of that happens in the first few chapters.
And also the lines are blurring between what happened in your life, Emer, and what happens in Aisling's life.
Not that Emer's a complete Aisling or anything.
No, I get that.
How dare you?
There's two of you in it. Ryan, I have my pre-order of Aisling in the City arriving in the next day or two, and I'm so excited to read it. Listening to the ladies in your show this morning has made me even more excited to read it. Tell the Aisling's to try the Aisling's.
That's what people call us now.
How do you feel about that?
We just answer to it.
Yeah. Oh, here's Aisling, and then there's also Aisling. They're both called Aisling.
What a coincidence.
We've got a pair of Aisling's today. Yeah. Tell the Aisling's to try business class on Etihad.
I've heard about this.
I haven't heard. I know nothing about
this. I
think
there's a bed.
No.
I think there's a full bed.
Like a duvet?
If anyone from Etihad is listening,
we're available to test drive all your planes.
Well, can you tell me, why am I so intellectually incurious about travelling to Dubai and these places? I have no interest at all.
I don't really either, but mostly because of the heat.
It's very hot and very sandy.
I struggled on Inish Boffin in July, I can tell you. Imagine
you were there for the heat wave.
I was there for the heat wave and I was being mocked by young people that I was with who I shouldn't read because I was wearing a shirt, trousers, shoes, on the beach.
Not long sleeves, Ryan.
I'm afraid so.
Ryan, shoes on the beach.
No, well, they were... listen, leave it
Did
anyway.
Did you have a job interview there later?
I had a book... over my face because the heat was so intense.
You are a caricature of yourself.
And they...
Look, listen, it doesn't sound too far.
And then they TikToked me. I was TikToked by them, mocking me.
I don't blame them now, to be honest.
Do you know what? They had good material in fairness. Okay, let's keep going. We flew business class to New York on Aer Lingus, and the best experience ever. And our president, Michael D, was in the top row with Sabina en route to address the UN. He was so lovely, he took time to say hello to everyone around him.
I mean, that's the other thing. You just don't know who you'd be like brushing shoulders
with
when you're
turning
left.
When Aisling is preparing to fly business class, she's in the airport going, people... probably think I'm working in the UN because I'm in the business class.
Yeah, because it looks not
there. And I've got a laptop bag.
Such business.
I brought a laptop bag.
I love that. You weren't given a laptop there by the... I was flown to Germany first class by my company in 1985, says Pete in Cork. The one and only time I felt like the Lord of the Manor. God, it really is.
It's too short a flight.
That's too
short.
To
Germany.
Yeah, that is very
I want to
short.
Be going to Australia.
You want a bed...
Yes, I want to be like in a cabin at the back.
Yeah, I hear you.
You'd need to fly to Australia just to do it, wouldn't you? Just
I've never
for that.
Been to, have you been to Australia either?
No, it's very long. No,
it's very long. And the heat. not to mention the heat. I'd love to do Australia to fly that way.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's the only way.
The only way.
I wouldn't fancy the legs up against my chin there.
Yeah. My mother has a brother in Tasmania and I've considered treating her to, and she's visited him before, but another visit. And going, we'll fly first class, will we? Just so we could do the flights.
Oh, I think you should.
Yeah, I think I should too.
It's why celebrities always get off planes looking so good. They haven't been scrunched up in a ball, you know, with their head against the tray table.
Matted.
In front of them. Yeah. They've been on a bed.
But I think, you know, the amount of people post-pandemic, as we're kind of in that zone now, people should be encouraged to do things that they said, I must do.
Yeah.
Like, you should do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's costly and you save, you make the money and so on, if you can. But definitely do it.
It would be lovely, wouldn't it?
We're trying to bring back YOLO. You know, you only live once.
Yeah.
It's coming
back.
My mother's at home now going, Jesus, no, I'm not getting on.
No, do. tell your mum, like, she's listening today, you know, you've got to do this. And especially as it's on the house, because your daughter's a successful author now. So she wants to say thank you for all the kindnesses.
Thank you
that
for
you
everything, mother.
That's more like it. That is more like it. Aer Lingus have been on. Is that true? That what they
I'll stop. Stop it.
Nate, I'm not joking. You, Aer Lingus have been on.
You're joking.
They want to talk to the two of you about bringing it to New York on
Stop
business.
Stop.
You're kidding.
No, it's not a joke.
Sarah's going to cry.
I am going to cry.
No, they really have.
No, you're messing. No, you're too much of a messer.
You are
shoes to the beach. I can't trust you.
You know my mother? She's 80 years old. She's had coffee yesterday. I promise on her life this is true. So don't do that lightly.
It was all worth it, Emer.
It's going to happen.
It's happening. We're making it in New York. Oh my God.
We did go to New York once together, and then Sarah broke the news while we were there that she was pregnant. And
I ruined it.
I bought a bottle of gin for us to share. Okay.
In steerage.
Well, now you can have that gin.
We'll have it on the flight.
On the flight.
For free.
That's brilliant. Are you going to get a little salt and peppers?
Oh, stop. Yes. They'll be in straight into my handbag.
Free sauce.
I'm sorry, Aer Lingus. I'm sorry. I couldn't leave them behind me.
Straight into the handbag. Anyway, lads, that's who knew? You came on to talk about a book and now you're flying to New York. Up the front. Yes. Oh, it's a lovely Irish reaction to it, I think. Flew Aer Lingus once for my 50th birthday, says Dara. It was my husband to New York City, and the five kids were down the back.
Good.
We were up there. And we're rereading all the Aisling's as we wait for the new one.
Oh,
there's a lot
that.
Of love for the book in terms of waiting for it, and they've been,
yeah.
You know,
it's been a long wait for people.
It has.
It's been over a year now at this stage.
Yeah, we took a year off last year, so it's been 2 years. Yeah. It's been 2 years since the third book, so yeah, it has been a long wait.
And even during lockdown, we got loads of messages from people going, "Oh, you know, the thought of this new Aisling book is getting us through."
Oh,
lockdown.
That's so sweet. Yeah. I mean, I believe that actually. Elaine in Rathfarnham says, "I got my confirmation yesterday. The book is on its way." Interesting to hear the girls' antipathy for the Karen phenomenon. I feel like there could be potential in maybe an Aisling versus Karen book or movie or TV series, which would be like their version of Alien versus Predator.
So which is which?
That took a leap. But isn't that Aisling versus Karen?
I think a lot of people probably who aren't familiar with Aisling might think she's a bit of a Karen. Like they might confuse
she's much nicer than that.
But no, she's completely different. She might complain to the manager, but she would have a good point to make.
And a good case, Yeah, she's got the heart, hasn't she? And I have my pre-order of Aisling in the City arriving the next day or two, and I'm so excited to read it. Listening to the ladies, and that is maybe more exciting. Just received my copy this minute. Can't wait to start. Love the girls; they make me smile. From Noreen Walls in Chapel, is it in Dublin?
Thank you, Noreen.
Good on you, Noreen. Another says I had to be forced to give the Aisling's books a go by one of our 20-something-year-old daughters. Exactly. Hold. To be honest, I was reluctant to read such a book, but thought it was beneath me. Anyway, read the book, all of them, and oh my God, I enjoyed it so much. I've carried Aisling with me in my heart ever since, and I find myself wondering and being concerned about Aisling's well-being, as if they were, she's one of my daughters, and I'm thrilled to hear Aisling's in New York. She might even bump into our daughter who's in New York. So thanks to the girls for giving me...
That was quite the U-turn, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
But you know, I'm a bit like that with things that become really popular. When everyone hypes something up, I'm like, you know what? I'm never going to watch that. Like, I've never seen Avatar because people just talk
You're
about
not
it too
much.
Never
bad.
Saw The Wire.
Yeah, I see, there you go.
Never saw Breaking Bad.
I didn't either.
Yeah, but you're right. It's that kind of contrary streak that runs through
you. Yeah, but you know, I love the people who are still pushing the book. So they're like, you just have to give it a go, give it a go.
Yeah.
So thank you to that person
who did
that.
It's very nice. Yeah. But as you say, that did take a turn because I could sense a frisson of anger in this studio.
Well, we've heard that story a few times. That's
have
not
you?
The first time. We'd be like, oh, I didn't think it would be for me. Or even like a lot of men would come up to us back before the pandemic. We would do a lot of book festivals and kind of events and stuff like that. And they would come up and say, you know, I didn't think I was going to like this. And then my wife or my daughter made me read it and I absolutely loved it. So
we call them the reluctant husbands.
Yes.
Well, I think that these books give men a certain insight into a world that they mightn't be familiar with enough and should be more. So I say thank you is what I'm trying to say. I was asked to change seats on Aer Lingus to allow a family sit together. And when I went to my new seat, it was in business class.
The dream.
Oh my God.
This is the dream, this kind of unexpected upgrade.
Isn't that what it is?
And you know, like I've read about this a lot online. Apparently, like if your seatbelt is broken or your TV is broken or something, you might get an upgrade. And I was on a flight once and the telly was broken. And I was like, well, I'm sorry, you know, my television is broken. What's going to happen? And I just had to sit there with a broken TV.
Oh no.
There was no upgrades available.
I once moved seats to allow families to sit together and they bought me a Toblerone.
Oh, that was nice.
Oh,
yes.
It's kind of like a confectional version of an upgrade.
It was almost the same, even though I had to move then to a middle seat. And I felt it was flying home from Canada, which is an epic flight.
Oh, that is epic. Yeah. I want to ask you about that. But you know what happened then? Now that the Aer Lingus guys have been on, that's karma for you doing what you did.
Oh, my God.
And the pain you had to suffer through.
It took a while.
Hey, karma, delayed karma is still karma, especially if it's good.
Crying into my Toblerone.
Crying into
Was it one of the big gigantic airport ones?
No, not even.
Like a normal one?
Yeah, I think so. Where did they even get it?
Oh, I don't think you can get them anymore.
Oh my God, they brought them with them. They had sandwiches and tinfoil and a Toblerone.
They were ready to get people to move and they had their tiny Toblerones as incentives.
Well, listen, it worked on me.
You were conned.
I was beside it, some heads, and they were having the full tinfoil sandwiches about a couple of years ago on a flight, and they and I just thought, fair enough. Yeah. And just as it ended, I thought, that's the end of that. They've enjoyed their sandwich, nothing wrong. They weren't smelly, the sandwiches, the people
no
were fine.
No eggs or tuna.
No eggs. But then out came the Tupperware for the dessert, and they had apple pie, and they were all like, it
a
was,
two course.
They were having it like a proper.
It's admirable. You treat yourself to an old muffin or something, wouldn't you? From
no.
the no,
no, they're too.
They were. Yeah.
They don't tend to be great.
The muffins are
now the Aer Lingus ones will be fantastic.
Well, they'll be baked on flight.
I'm talking about any other airline.
Dorothy says, I want to be on that flight in business class when they're going. No, you don't, Dorothy, because to be honest with you,
it could get rowdy.
It'll get very rowdy very quickly when they're into the third
cocktail of the day.
Cocktail of the day. Cocktail of the week. I had a rush of blood to the head once and bid for a transatlantic upgrade with Aer Lingus' Mary in Galway. However, I made an idiot of myself by trying to flip the television screen back down towards me, thinking it was a tray. And the experience was tremendous. My daughter lives in Sydney, and definitely next time I visit, I'm flying business class.
YOLO.
Says Jane. YOLO. And that is what you and your mum are going to be doing quite soon.
Absolutely. Confirmed.
I'm pushing that button. You're going there. I got upgraded to business class on Aeroflot. That's Russia, isn't it? In 1994.
Yeah.
I was going back. So you get Toblerone. Congratulations. You have seat.
Yeah, I'd like to know more about the amenities on that flight.
I would love to know that. We don't torture you. Okay. I met Emer and Sarah at a book signing at Newbridge Silverware a few years ago.
That was a lovely day.
So much fun. What a gas place for a book signing.
I was going to say, very Aisling.
There was like
friendly.
Us. They had like a jumper Princess Diana once wore.
Yes,
like
they have the weirdest stuff.
Michael Jackson socks or something. It was
I hope
and a little book section.
Yeah.
I think the socks might have been cancelled. anyway, they signed my book, which I found absolutely brilliant. Thanks, girls, for making me laugh. Isn't that lovely to be thanked for making cheering people up?
I know. It is really nice.
It is nice.
Yeah. Bask in the glow. delighted to hear the fabulous friends and creators of Aisling are on with you today. It's great to see two friends are successfully working together and having the crack. Female friendship is a beautiful thing, says Teresa in Cork. It is possible to work with friends. I worked with my friend Sylvia Lopez for the past 5 years, and the support and fun we've had, the ups and downs of creating Hola students together. Admittedly, she lives in Madrid now, but we chat daily. So bravo to the duo. Great role models for female powered creation.
Oh,
lovely.
That is so nice. That
Teresa
is
Hart.
Nice.
Morning, Teresa. And she said Dubray Books will be opening in Cork soon, so you'll be down there doing a signing.
I believe we're going to Cork.
We'll be in Cork next week.
I believe we're going to Cork.
Any excuse? Put us on the train?
Is there business class on the train?
I bet there is.
There is a sort
you
of
know Ryan.
I was waiting for it. There is a carriage, isn't there?
I wouldn't know.
There aren't a witty carriage.
Just to accommodate my ego. It's quite long. Can't wait to read the book. I love Aisling. My company once sent me on a return business class flight to San Francisco for a 5-month project. My fiancé came to visit me for the last three weeks. I gave him my business class seat on the way home, and that's how I knew it must be love.
Oh, because she wanted him to experience it.
Yes.
That's very nice.
I should point out that my flight home that time was not business class, and I cried all the way home.
Okay. So it was a one-way ticket.
It was a one-way business class flight, yeah. That was grim.
Was that given to you, or did you?
No, I bought it, but I had bought the flight quite last minute, and when you buy something last minute like that, transatlantic, the prices aren't that different.
This is
and
how was she was like, justifying it to me. It's not that different.
The price difference isn't that huge.
It's not prohibitive. Okay, let's keep going. 515-51 flew business class from Melbourne 3 years ago. However, today I would take a rowing boat to Melbourne to see my family. That's horrible for me. I have laughed out loud this morning listening to the girls. Thanks for the great start to my day. Well done to Aer Lingus for treating them to a wonderful business class experience. Enjoy, ladies.
Oh, thanks for the reminder.
It's kind of giddy. I feel excited.
What if they're just pranking us, Emer?
I would say lower your expectations.
I think that the suggestion seems to be, we look forward to bringing the girls to New York, but you there's three seats and you have to bring Ryan with you.
Pods at least.
At least you'll be kind of, they didn't say they'd be together.
Give us your tiny salt and pepper
for your handbag.
Are you bringing that home? Give it to me. So
are you using those socks?
Wake up, you're not listening.
You're missing. Here's matchsticks for your eyes. Look at us. We see everybody. Look, there's Paul Brady's over there. Took my niece Emma to New York for the first time flying on business class. Upgraded as I won the flight tickets in a competition. And the airlines were brilliant. We had a laugh. A lot of love for all of this, to be honest with you. People are enjoying it immensely. So now that this is all put to bed, you've got your fifth book is the next one. We'll talk about that again. But why a quintet? Why not keep on going as you're on to such a good thing?
I think we always said that we just didn't want to drag it out too much. And we wanted to leave people wanting more from Aisling. And it's not like we think we're going to run out of ideas, but the ideas that we have at the moment are really strong.
Okay.
And we just don't want to dilute it by doing it constantly. I think our publisher would like us to do a book every year for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
But there are other things that we want to do as well, like individually and together. And I think five books. It's just, you know.
And when we wrote the first Aisling book, we thought it was just going to be one book. It was never supposed to be a series. We never thought it was going to be a success. And then it was like, well, maybe we'll do three. Like, maybe could we get a story
a
in three?
Yeah.
And then they did. And then it was like, okay, we'll do five. And we just felt like that. Like, I'm kind of anticipating it being quite sad, but kind of looking forward to drawing the story to a close next year.
Oh, I'm emotional thinking about it. Yeah.
Lads, I went to see James Bond last week. And, you know, it's Daniel Craig's last one.
Yeah.
First time in my life, I found myself quite moved by the ending. I was going, oh, he's gone. Because it's kind of end of an era in life and so on. And so I think Aisling's departure in book five or wherever she goes, so I'm sure you've kind of put her to wherever she is. Don't kill her.
We're not going to make any promises.
Can you imagine?
Goodbye, Aisling. Goodbye.
No, we'll keep her safe. Oh, she'll be okay.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. I know there was talk of a movie. That's now a TV series. You're writing the screenplay for that, if that's the right way of putting it.
Yes, we've pivoted to TV, which is exciting.
Yeah.
We have just written the pilot and then set the outline for the next seven episodes. So we're hoping to get that picked up.
Has that been cast yet? No.
No.
Not yet.
I would imagine one of your favourite conversations together is casting Aisling.
Oh, we do it all the time.
I bet you do. It's like, what would you do if you won the lotto?
Yeah, and people come up to us on the street and like, would you consider Saoirse for the role of Aisling?
Oh, I bet.
Or like, would Saoirse consider the role of Aisling? Is more of a question.
That's more like it.
I know Saoirse is too cool for Aisling. Not to say Aisling has her cool moment. No, she doesn't. What am I talking about?
Saoirse is more of a Sive.
There's a character called Sive who's Aisling's very cool hipster friend.
Yeah, she'd be. I'm racking my brains to see who'd be other
like
contenders.
We honestly don't really have one name in mind for Aisling. We get asked this all the time, and especially when it was going to be a movie, it was like, who's going to play Aisling? But we think it'll probably be like a find.
It'll be
an actress.
Like, to discover someone. Wouldn't that be cool?
You could be gender neutral and cast Aidan Turner.
This is it.
Take
your top off there, Aisling. Have you got a side, Aisling?
Side in the city.
Yeah.
Can you ask the girls how they write the books? Oh, good Lord, that's a big question. Honora, do they write them together or take chapters or whatever? So I know that you ask that a lot. So the quick answer to that is,
we do kind of alternate chapters, and we figure out what's going to happen at the start of a chapter and at the end, and then we go away and fill in the blanks. We do it on Google Docs, which is just, there's no security there. It's extremely lo-fi, but it's how we did the first book, and we're afraid to change it.
And then we edit the books together, so they're seamless.
Thank you. That answers that.
If you do say so.
Ladies, somebody says, ladies, addressing you both.
Thank you.
My sister-in-law is going through some treatment in Singapore. Would you, I sent her all the Aisling books as a distraction. Thank you for the humour. So she's going through in Singapore, away from home, and then chuckling away at Aisling's experience. That's a really nice thing.
That's really nice to hear.
The tale of Muhammad Ali changing his first class seat for a man who was having health issues in standard class. He stayed there for the whole of the flight, and everyone around him were delighted by his company. There's John.
That'll be you now, Sarah.
Health issues. That seems to be the key to getting to first class.
On our honeymoon in Aer Lingus flight to Sicily, I noticed a male passenger across the aisle looking unwell. I said hello to him, but he didn't respond, and he was in the midst of a cardiac event. I said hello! Anyway,
answer me!
Rude. Anyway, sorry. Aer Lingus diverted to Gatwick, and he had a procedure in the hotel, in the hospital, and he's fine. And the feedback from Aer Lingus said he survived. Aer Lingus were great, treated me and my husband to free champagne.
Oh, lovely. That's lovely. I have a friend who was once on a flight home from Las Vegas, and she was so hungover, they considered diverting the flight.
The most Irish
Can you
diversion.
Imagine?
Oh, very Magella move there.
We have to go. We could be here all day. So much more in on that. And guys, New York, it's on your agenda
see
now.
See you there.
Yeah,
we'll
see you there.
The Aisling tour. Oh, we're like visiting all the spots in the book
yeah.
that we made up.
Eimear McGleisdead and Sarah Breen, so good to see you. I really always enjoy your company. Thanks for being with me today and with all of us. Ashling in the City is out now as of today, and you can get that in all good bookshops, and do try and get it in your local bookshop and support them all there if you can. And you're on a book tour. Will you be doing signings and things?
We can't have like actual signings in shops now because of the congestion. So we are going to be going to bookshops around Dublin and signing stock. So if you go to your local bookshop, you might get
find
a signed
book. Yeah.
Thank you. Great to see you.
And you.
Bon voyage. Yeah, nice. Well, I met this gentleman via Zoom last February on the Late Late Show over on Friday nights, but I'm delighted to be talking to him again. Dave Grohl is one of the most affable men in rock and roll, no doubt about that. And he has written about his ongoing career from underground punk rock drummer to stadium-busting frontman with his band The Foo Fighters. He's got such a story to tell, and he always tells it in a delightful way. Dave Grohl, welcome to the programme. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
Every time I talk to you, it's our second time. But when I get to speak to you, I think two things. And one is your very profound connection to this country. And we spoke before about you ringing your mother the morning you woke up in Cork in 1991 when you were on your first tour in Nirvana. But this time, Ireland featuring again in the book. But you were at a very different crossroads in your life when you saw a young man hitchhiking in Dingle.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yes, it was after Nirvana ended. I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do. I didn't necessarily want to play music. And I was young. I think I was 25 years old. Mm. And I'd been to Ireland before and made my way around the Ring of Kerry once before. And so I rented a car and wound up driving. I flew over and I just started driving around, you know, just sort of trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. And as I was coming around this country road, I saw a hitchhiker. And I thought, you know, he was young and it was sort of raining. And I thought, well, maybe I'll pick him up. And as I got closer, I noticed that he had a Kurt Cobain T-shirt on. And that was the moment where I realized, you know, I need to go home and figure this out. And that's when I started the Foo Fighters.
When you have a sort of cathartic moment like that in your life at such a young age, I often wonder, like, how equipped are you emotionally or mentally to handle those decisions and those life experiences? Looking back now as a dad and as an accomplished artist, you've seen such a callow youth.
Well, you know, I think that when you come to those crossroads in life, no matter how old you are, you make the decision and you have to, you know, you have to live with the consequence of that decision. And so that's one of the most challenging things about navigating life is, you know, you make the decision and you cross your fingers and hope that you made the best one. Sometimes you don't, you know. And for me, when Nirvana became popular, I think I was 21 or 22 years old.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anyone's emotionally, you know, qualified or capable to navigate that kind of experience at any age. But, you know, when you're young, you just kind of have to steer the wheel. You just kind of keep going in a forward direction.
But when you go back another, say, decade in your life, when you're 16, and you talk about touring the US and Europe and you know, your mother waving you off and living on $7 a day. And do you ever look back at those times in the innocence of it, not being well known, and think, sometimes I enjoyed that innocence more than I enjoyed the big stuff?
Oh, no, the big stuff's much better.
Okay, so no Rosebud for you then.
No, it's much better now. You know, I'm walking around a hotel suite talking to someone on the radio station. I much prefer this.
Yeah.
I think the good thing about those early years was that it really does sort of like lay this foundation.
Mm.
And so you use it as to keep this perspective on everything for the rest of your life. Like, I wouldn't be as appreciative as I am now without those experiences. And of course, you know, I mean, yes, it was great. I left school. I jumped in a van with some people. We drove around and slept on floors and played rock and roll every night. Mm. It was beautiful. It was great. But I did learn to survive back then on almost nothing. So now every time I walk into a backstage and I see that, oh, there's some free beer in that bucket. Like, I still to this day, I look at it and I think, okay, all right, this is fine. This is good.
Yeah. That's the point I think I was trying to make quite badly, was that you weren't born into a life of buckets full of free beer. You had to earn
them. No. There was no free beer until about 1991. Then it was everywhere.
I love just reminding people who didn't see that the last time you joined us on the TV show was you're chatting about your mother and how you got to Ireland. You looked around and suddenly saw your mother everywhere. You realized the profound nature of the Irish gene in your family.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew that we had Irish heritage in our family, but I'd never been. So the first time I came, I woke up, I walked outside, and everyone looked like my mother. I ran back to the phone and I called her. I'm like, Mom, everybody looks exactly like you here.
Actually, I'll come back to the book in a moment, Dave, but when we spoke the last time, your mother was very actively talking about teaching and with the Biden administration, and now that that's bedded in a little, how is she doing, and is she still flying that flag?
Yeah, she's well. I mean, listen, she was a public school teacher her entire life. 35 years she taught public school. And I think, in order to become a teacher, you have to have a very specific disposition. Most teachers are, they're altruistic and they're caring and they're giving. They devote their lives to other people. And she is that way. She's still that way. I mean, I talk to her every day. She's my best friend. And so she's doing well. I think that, it's still a challenge to try to bring things back to where they were before, which I don't know if that's entirely possible, but to get them to a place where kids, can feel comfortable in a group learning environment again. But, that's what teachers do. Yes. They figure out how to get the kids to the next step. And if that takes adapting and change, they'll figure it out, because they're the smart ones, It's not us. They're the smart ones.
When you say they, the kids or the teachers?
The teachers.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm led by the next generation, but equally I'm in awe of the teachers in society.
Oh, they're amazing people. And I was raised in a community of them, and I have nothing but respect for them all.
Do you know, you used to go to jazz clubs with your mother. And
I did, yeah.
What I'm so intrigued about you is how democratic you are about the music that inspired you and that you continue to love. So you don't say, you don't have to name check the quote unquote cool music down through the years. You're happy to say that it was this, that, and the other. Where some people say you've got to say the Rolling Stones, not say the Beatles. You always go, no, I'm a Beatles guy or Neil Diamond or whatever it might be. Can you talk to me about that, about the lack of snobbery in your approach to music?
Well, I still feel the same as I did when I was a young boy in my bedroom learning how to play guitar. So back then, I knew nothing about cool, and I didn't know anything about what to listen to or what not to listen to. I just took everything in, and I mean, it could be like doo-wop, Manhattan Transfer music, or a show tune, or Aerosmith. Or AC/DC. Like, to me, music was just this beautiful puzzle or this mystery that I was trying to figure out. It didn't matter what type or what genre of music. But I really think that, I think it's important for people to remember that there should be no guilty pleasure. Yeah. There should just be pleasure. And whether it's Gangnam Style or Let It Be, who cares? Like, it's music. And if you dig it, then you should dig it and be okay with that. So, yeah, I mean, a long time ago, my mother, she always gave great advice. And she said, I asked her about peer pressure when she was young. Yeah. And she said, I never compared myself to other people. She said, I always just felt like my own person. I never compared myself to anyone else. And I thought that was, it's one of my favorite little nuggets of wisdom that she's given me. So I've never really felt any pressure to be cool. And to be honest, I've never felt cool. I've always felt like a nerd. I still do. So I can I could feel okay with loving the new pop artist that just came out. I'm into it. It's okay.
Isn't that you're in a very safe harbor here? I can tell you with those feelings, because it is a very, very lovely place to arrive at when you embrace the nerdism and say, this is what and who I am, and I can't fight it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it feels good to be able to say that.
I would have thought so. When you look at, like, punk music got you on the road when you were young, and That's why I think some people go, God, he must be that must be his bailiwick, and that's where he should be. But why was it that particular genre of music, let's say, that kind of brought you into the big time, in a manner of speaking?
Well, you know, one of the things I loved the most about the underground punk rock scene was the independence of it. You know, when I was young, in my bedroom, I had posters on the wall that had Zeppelin posters and Beatles posters and Kiss posters and things like that. And so I thought that was, you know, I thought that was rock and roll. I thought rock and roll was like lasers and dragons and explosions. And it didn't seem attainable to me. It just seemed like this fantasy world. And then the first time I ever saw a band play was a punk rock band in a small club in Chicago. And I mean, they had three amplifiers, one microphone, there were maybe two lights on the stage, and they knew four chords. And that, to me, the first time I saw a live band perform, it was so simple and so raw and so pure. And I realized, oh my, I can do this. Like, I know those four chords. I have some friends. We could put together a band. We could find a small club. We can do it. And there was something about the independence of it, where everyone was making records on their own, and they'd start their own record company, and they'd make their own albums and write their own songs. And that to me, I was so attracted to the idea that I could do it as well. And so that's why it was so influential to me. Of course, the music, it was like the music was raw. There was energy. There was this like excitement to it. But the thing that I loved the most was that I could do it too. And so that's really kind of what began. It began, you know, me starting the Foo Fighters or me touring the world, things like that. Yeah. It all started with the idea that I could do it.
And boy, did you do it in style, Nirvana, Foo Fighters, and on it goes. And yet, in the middle of it all, Dave, you have this, I got this sense about you, and if I may be wrong, but that you're still a fan. You're a fan of, you know, you talk about the posters in your bedroom as a kid. The next thing you know, you've got Paul McCartney knocking on your front door when your child is born, and you're thinking, you know, is this my new normal? I mean, it's bonkers.
It's never normal. I mean, that's one of the things about the book. When I started writing the book, you know, the book is basically written from the perspective of someone who's having an out-of-body experience all the time. Like, I'm watching this happen to someone else. Yeah. It's hard to believe that it's happening to me. So, I mean, you know, I've had the pleasure and the honor to meet some of my great heroes. And when I do, you know, I try to be present and I try to just think of us all as human beings. But no, it's like, it's Paul McCartney. It's Ringo Starr. Yeah. It's Mick Jagger. Yeah. It's like, it's these people that really shaped my life. And it never feels normal, but it feels okay.
What do you do when you're at the White House and the president is giving McCartney an award and you're told, yeah, listen, play the drums there, and then they add another request on top of it? I mean, do you freak out, or how do you roll with that?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I was young, we would go to these sort of like political protest concerts on the Mall in Washington, D.C. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., and so they would have these concerts on the 4th of July with punk rock bands, like real sort of like punk rock protest concerts. And there was the Rock Against Reagan concert. That was a big one. They had it every year. And it was like the conservative administration. And there's all these punks down there like screaming at the president. And then, you know, years later, now I'm at the White House playing on the South Lawn in Obama's first year as president. And all I could think was like, I made it over the fence.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I used
yeah,
to be
yeah.
over there,
yeah.
And now I made it over the fence, and so did President Obama. Like,
yeah.
We made it over the fence, and here we are. So now, you know, it's kind of like this slow change of getting your foot in the door. And whenever, you know, when you go to the White House and you're invited to one of those functions, you know, there's a certain level of it feels surreal in a way, but you definitely feel honored to be there, because it's, you know, it's as a Washington D.C. boy, my hometown, to make my way over that fence and share an experience with the president is, you know, it's an honor. I enjoy doing it.
Would you describe fatherhood, three daughters, as your greatest achievement, or am I putting words in your mouth?
No question. Yes, my daughters are, they're the love of my life. They're all brilliant people. They're an adventure in themselves. Like every morning I wake up and I think, oh God, what's going to happen today? But I love watching them become the people that they're becoming. And yeah, it's great. I mean, it's the only thing I like to do other than play music is to be a dad. That's basically it. That's all I do.
Well, hear, hear to that. Our time has come to an end, sadly, but thank you so much for your time today, Dave Grohl. It's been lovely to talk to you again, and we'll see you soon in Ireland, hopefully. Take care.
All right. We'll see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Dave Grohl is obviously the singer, the artist and the writer of the storyteller, Tales of Life and Music. And we'd urge you to buy that from your local bookshop if you can. And just one of the good guys, simple as that. Lovely to talk to him this morning. The text number is always 51551.